Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a present. Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a presentation sponsored by www.livinglies.wordpress.com, GTC Honored, and The Garfield Firm, serving all 50 states with news and analysis of the latest bank scams against borrowers, homeowners, consumers, and investors, and providing legal representation throughout Florida. This program is for general information only. It is not a solicitation for services or legal representation and should never be used as a substitute for advice from a licensed professional. And now, here's world-renowned financial expert, attorney, and blogger, Neil Garfield.
Hi, this is Neil Garfield, and this is November 13th, 2014. I'm broadcasting live from Boynton Beach, Florida. And I was just up in Orlando area, and I will be in other areas of the state over the next couple of weeks. But tonight, we're going to be talking about a number of things. I'm going to have to go off of memory because my screen just went blank and my computer is rebooting, which, of course, is Murphy's Law. I want to start off with the notion of what most of these loans are about. Now, this doesn't mean that it's about all of the mortgage loans, but I think it applies to 96% of them based upon the reporting of the major banks about how many loans were portfolio loans and how many were subject to claims of securitization. And I was in the process of training some people and explaining the process of securitization, not as it was meant to be, but how it was done by Wall Street. And if you can imagine that you wrote a check for $1,000 to Best Buy or Walmart or whoever for the purchase of a TV, and somehow or other, the bank that you wrote the check on claimed that they had a right to the TV, you would say that's nuts. And yet, if they went to court and showed that they paid Best Buy for the TV and didn't bother to say that the money came from you, the bank that was doing that would actually have a facially valid case. Now, they couldn't win once all the facts came out, but they could plead it and survive a motion to dismiss. Now, that's kind of an oversimplification, but maybe we need some of that in order to get the message across. Because at the point of closing, the same situation as the Best Buy situation was happening. And the point here is that the money came from investors on Wall Street, and that's who you borrowed from. When you signed the note, which is like a check, and you sign the mortgage, you created facially valid instruments which could be used in a lawsuit and would survive a motion to dismiss. The problem with, of course, those documents is that they are false documents, as I wrote about in this morning's article, and you'll be reading more about that tomorrow when I do tomorrow morning's article on the blog. And I encourage people to read carefully the last five or six posts on the blog, because I think they will educate you to a significant degree and help you actually get what is going on here. And so when you sign that note, you're creating a second liability, even though you've got money from the investor and you owe it to them because that's who you got the money from. You've signed the note to somebody unrelated to the investor, and that's an important fact. They are unrelated to the investor. They have no contractual relationship with them, nor any other relationship with them. And in some cases, which is something that I'll be writing about tomorrow morning, the so-called lender that appears on the note and the mortgage doesn't even exist. So when you sign those papers, you are creating a second liability, a second debt, even though you didn't get the money twice. You only got it once from the investors. So the important thing to remember is that in many of, probably the great majority of these loans, what we are actually dealing with is false papers that were discussed in the Arizona decision that I wrote about this week. And now in Arizona, that was upheld as a cause of action. The problem with these false papers is that they can still be used against you because you signed them. And the reason for that is there are laws governing the use of commercial paper, negotiable instruments under the Uniform Commercial Code. That's why you hear people saying UCC, that's the Uniform Commercial Code. Article 3 and 9 primarily are the ones that govern. Article 3 governs the note. Article 9 governs the mortgage. So if all these papers are false, how could you lose? Well, you could lose by default if you don't answer and don't do anything. But you can also lose, and many people do lose, because they've essentially filed papers that that waive defenses and waive issues and admit things that they really don't know anything about. So the reason for, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, the reason why homeowners lose in these battles is because they actually don't understand what went on, and because they say things that are used against them, either through their lawyer or if they're litigating for themselves, pro se. So, for example, in the Middle District of Florida decision that I'll be writing about tomorrow morning, the so-called lender was American Brokers Conduit. Now, you would think that with a name like American Brokers Conduit, you would think that people would realize, well, if it's a conduit, that's one step removed from being a lender, and if it's a broker, that's two steps from being a lender. But beyond that, in Florida, American Brokers Conduit did not exist. It was unregistered. And we already have a second district opinion saying that the mortgage is void if the entity did not legally exist. Because the whole point of Florida law is that you have to register if you want to do business in the state, or you have to incorporate here. And if you don't do that, then you have no right to make any claim or even defend any action against you. Now, in this case, the fact that the entity never existed means, by definition, that it could never have funded the loan. But in the Middle District case that I'll be talking about tomorrow, you'll see that that point was completely missed, or if it wasn't missed, then it was, certainly was not addressed in any way that made sense to the judge because the judge said that he's treating American Brokers Conduit and AHMSI as one and the same entity, which by definition means that he was giving them the status of being the lender using American Brokers Conduit as a fictitious name, which was never registered. It was an incorrect decision on that basis, but apparently there was no proper objection made because it would appear as though neither the homeowner nor any attorney that was involved at the trial stage was aware of the fact that American Brokers Conduit didn't exist and was unregistered, and therefore the mortgage and note were void, which would leave you with the debt that's owed to the investors. Of course, the investors are not coming in to press claims against individual borrowers because they're run by fund managers whose jobs depend upon the success of the fund. So if they went against the actual borrowers, they would be admitting to the fact that they, at least they now know, that the trust never got the loan, they never paid for the loan, and that leads, of course, to the question of whoever it was that says that they transferred the loan into the trust. Well, why did they transfer a valuable loan, supposedly valuable loan, and not receive any payment? And the answer is because they didn't pay for it. And you keep going down the line until you get to American Brokers Conduit, who clearly was not given any money because it didn't exist. And that's how you attack the validity of the mortgage and the note themselves. When you attack that successfully, then everything after that becomes a nullity, with the exception of, under the UCC, a holder in due course who the law says, rightly or wrongly, philosophically you could agree or disagree, but it's not important whether you agree. What's important is what the law says. If you achieve the status of a holder in due course, then you can enforce the paper that you purchased for value without knowledge of the borrower's defenses and in good faith all the way around, then you can enforce that, the note and the mortgage, against the homeowner, even though the papers were false. And that leaves the homeowner with a right of action against, theoretically, American Brokers Conduit, but that won't do you any good because they don't exist, or in that case, in the Middle District, AHMSI. And we've seen that appear, American Brokers Conduit, with Wells Fargo and a bunch of other people. And what you will find if you study this and you think about it and you process it is that what's fundamentally wrong and the reason why none of the loans, well, practically none of the loans, were modified or settled is that the bank, like in my example at the beginning, was taking a position that was not backed up by the facts or, in fact, the law. The bank can't step in between the lender, the depository bank in which the investment account is held, or a depository bank, a depository account is held. The bank can't step in and say they have rights against one party or the other in connection with the transaction between the investor and the borrower. And the fact that the paperwork all says that it was a different lender doesn't take anything away from the fact that it was the investors who loaned the money. And the money was filtered down through a number of conduits, just like in a bank transaction where you wrote your check to Best Buy The check is deposited in Best Buy's bank account. Best Buy's bank then presents the check to the bank that you wrote the check on from your own account, and you have those two banks that are involved, but neither one of them has a right to the TV, and nor could you, you know, sue the bank if there was anything wrong with the TV. The situation in these loans is very similar to that because there's a bunch of conduits, depository entities that are not necessarily banks, to which the investor funds were sent down to your closing table, and that's why the transaction is between you and the investor. Now, should they have disclosed that? Well, the Middle District opinion says, yes, they should have. But in that decision, it's obvious that the judge was not made aware of any claim on the part of the homeowner regarding disclosures other than some issues that could easily be disposed of. And if they had gone after the disclosures as provided in the Truth in Lending Act, TILA as it's known as, and Reg Z from the Federal Reserve, which interprets the Truth in Lending Act, they would have known instantly that if it's American Brokers Conduit, and I'm harping on that because that's the subject of that case, and I have another one that's pretty similar, that the type of loan closing was a table-funded loan, which means that somebody else funded the loan, which under Reg Z is predatory per se. So in other words, what that means is that you don't have to say any more or prove anything else, but that the money came from somebody else and it wasn't disclosed and they weren't the real lender. The real lender was not on the note and mortgage. And the fact that it came from somebody else, the money came from somebody else, is sufficient for it to be predatory per se. If the homeowner had brought that claim, the court would have at least had an opportunity to rule a different way. And the court ruled there that rescission was not available because all the appropriate disclosures were made. And the reason why the court decided that all the appropriate disclosures were made is that the parties agreed that the only issues that were present were the ones talked about in that opinion. But even I, without necessarily knowing all the background facts, was able to spot a number of issues where, just from the opinion of the judge, the federal judge in that case, where there were other things far more important that could have been brought to the judge's attention. So how do you lose a case that should be unlosable? Well, simply by letting a default go by admitting things that are not true, by failing to object in a timely fashion, and moving to strike and opposing motions for summary judgment with real facts as you believe you know them, and then following that up with very aggressive discovery with a motion to compel that really explains what your theory of the case is and why you need the answers to those questions or the documents that are cited in your request for production or the admissions that you're looking for in the request for admission. And when you look at the games that are being played by the banks here, it's obvious to the casual observer who understands trial procedure that the bank is playing games when, for example, and I just got another one today, a witness and exhibit list where the number of witnesses was 25, no contact information, nor any specific information about what each witness might testify to. And that's the equivalent of no notice at all, because we all know they're only bringing in one witness, and we all know that they're giving us 25 names so that we can't figure out which one it is, and therefore we would have to investigate 25 witnesses, maybe take the deposition of 25 witnesses, which is outside of economic reality for most homeowners. Now, why would a real party in interest go through all those games? Well, the simple answer is because they're hiding something, and they don't want anyone to know what's really going on. So that's about the best I can do off of memory without my notes in front of me. We'll go to questions. I want you to think about what you really know about your closing, or if you're the lawyer on the line, think about what you really know about the loan closing, and not think in terms of what your experience is, but see what is really evident. Because you might be tempted to say, as we've often heard from judges, did you get the money? Yes. Well, no, they didn't get the money. They got money, but it wasn't the money that was talked about in the note and the mortgage. So it's obvious that that things are not being dealt with in an honest fashion by the banks, or they would, first of all, come right up with the information that they need in order to simply win the case and move on with their foreclosure. And there would be a lot more workouts under the circumstances where the prices were so much higher than the actual values of the property. So I'll take a few questions here. The first number I've got is area code 239, I think. If there is somebody there with a question, I'm having it texted to me because my computer is not helping me at all. 239 area code. All right, then we'll go to the 904 area code. Do you have a question?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Did you, the first one's a short one. Did you ever recover your vehicle that got stolen?
Yes, and with all my files in it, too. It was a bunch of teenagers. Yeah, I think it was a bunch of teenagers out for a joyride. So thank you for asking. What's the second question?
The other one was, I got to go to something called on December. They haven't done anything in the files with the they changed attorneys, and then they haven't sent anything in. The other attorney, the only thing they did was they asked MERS if they had any interest, and there's nothing to do with the MERS mortgage. It was with Option 1 Mortgage, Sand Canyon. I got to go to this administration thing. If the other side doesn't show up, then it'll be dismissed, won't it? And what should I do at that meeting?
Well, I can't tell you what you should do because I would be giving you legal advice. But ordinarily what people do is they insist on knowing that whoever is showing up actually represents the creditor directly or indirectly. And if they don't show up at all, then they normally insist on a dismissal. And more often than not now, judges are granting that motion for involuntary dismissal. So if you have a lawyer or you have access to a lawyer, there are things that we can do for you where if the lawyer is on the phone, then I can be more open in the way that I respond to a question like that. But you need to, for the procedure in your area, you need to talk to a lawyer who is licensed in the jurisdiction in which the property is located, but also to a lawyer who is familiar with the court system and et cetera in the area where your action is pending. So that's the best answer I can give you in a show like this.
Okay.
They'll
dismiss it with non-prejudice, so they'll try to find it. I've already proven through a notary administration process where the notary verifies everything that they don't have the note, they don't have the original note. They send the note in an 8.5 by 10 inch piece of paper, and the original note was on an 8.5 by 14, and it's got a blank. What do you call that? Not an addendum. What's the attachment? It's supposed to be permanently attached to the original promissory
the
note.
Yeah, the blank allonge.
Yeah, the blank allonge, and it's not signed to anybody, so it's not any good unless it's attached to the original promissory note permanently attached.
Well, that generally is true, and the use of those blank allonges has been like an epidemic. And in years before all of this mortgage nonsense, practically no judge would accept that kind of an allonge without extensive testimony as to why a blank piece of paper was attached and when it was attached and all of that.
They have to show up in person. There's no telephone conversation. The other side has to show up in person. And should I take in get a person to go in with me that records everything on that, you know, the shorthand?
Yes. Yes. Yes, definitely.
Okay. Well,
All right. We're running out of time here, but we'll try 224 area code.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Garfield. Thank you for taking
my
call.
Yes, you need to make this quick. We have about 90 seconds.
Okay. I've got a question about the note holder. I recently was involved in a deposition that I had to answer questions to. But prior to that deposition, I found out through a request to admit facts that the party now has asserted that they are no longer the note holder, that its servicer is now the note holder. Do I have to provide any kind of discovery to that new entity? Because they've been harping on me to provide them the information
okay,
that I have. However, they're not a not a whole note holder anymore.
Okay, I can only give you about a 20-second answer. The discovery should be from you to them to explain how that transaction occurred and what was behind it, and whether the party that executed the transfer owned the loan, which I'm sure they did not, and that's why they signed it over to the servicer to create another layer between them and another layer between you and them. I have to cut off now. We go to the outro. I'll be back next week. And
thanks for listening to our broadcast. We hope that you tell your friends about us and let them know that there is hope and help in this financial crisis. Tune in every week to The Neil Garfield Show for free information and advice, and visit our blog daily at The Living Lies Blog. We provide support services, the latest strategies, analysis, expert consultations, testimony, and declarations to use in your battle against the largest economic crime in human history. For information concerning Neil, the team at Living Lies, or the law firm, go to www.livinglies.wordpress.com or call 520-405-1688. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and should not be attributed to any other person or entity.
End the episode.